today. And Steve, you want to give us a preview?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 428A comes to you from the Senate Education Committee. This bill would establish the Student Bill of Rights Program. And what the Student Bill of Rights Program is it would allow students in grades 11 and 12 to attend post-secondary institutions in Oregon, either community colleges, higher ed institutions, or private nonprofit accredited four-year institutions here in Oregon. And the school districts would essentially pay for the tuition costs of the students that were attending these institutions. So the students would be able to attend without tuition charge generally, and the school district would pay for these programs. There would also, this is modeled on a similar program that is in place in Minnesota. There are a number of provisions in this bill. One of them would allow the students to receive credit for both high school and college at the same time. So this would be very beneficial to the students. There'll be more testimony to discuss how the program will work that will be coming up. Since this is a fiscal office, I would like to speak a little bit about the fiscal impact before the testimony starts. We do have, we've distributed to you a staff measure summary from the Senate Education Committee. And this does give you some explanation of the bill. And then we've attached to that both our fiscal impact statement and a revenue impact statement prepared by the Legislative Revenue Office. Unfortunately, we are calling the effect on expenditures indeterminate, and I would like to explain a little bit about our thinking on that. There are really three types of impacts or expenses that we would want to look at in this particular case. One would be the impact of the bill on, you might just want to call them administrative expenses, so not the direct educational expense, but the administration of the program. Will this be an expensive program to administer? We did not hear back from state agencies that they would have any costs associated with administering this program. Particularly, the Department of Education said that they wouldn't have any costs administering the program, though I'm a little skeptical about that, frankly. It does, this bill does place certain requirements on the Department of Education. They would be required to adjudicate disputes about when students are eligible for this program and when they are not. And I think I would like to revisit with the Department of Education to make sure that they really are comfortable stating that they don't have any administrative costs associated with the program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burgess.
Would we also have the opportunity to visit with the Department of Education here in this public hearing?
Certainly, we could ask them to come in and
so that we can get at the concerns that you're raising.
The second point is more not looking at the administration of the program, but just at the basic cost of providing the educational cost. That is to say, will it be more or less expensive for the state to allow students to attend a and receive post-secondary education in lieu of their regular high school courses while they're in their 11th and 12th grade? And we are unable to say what the answer to that is. There are a lot of factors that are involved. In some cases, it might be less expensive for a student to be educated at a post-secondary institution, and in some cases, it might be more. For example, you can consider a student, a high school student, who's considering taking a history course at their high school or taking an introductory history course at, say, an OUS institution. Well, the course that's being taught by at the OUS institution, since it's a, you know, 100-level course, an introductory history course, there might, this might be a large lecture course which has over 100 students in it. Whereas in the high school program, this wouldn't be the case. And it might be less expensive, actually, on a per-student basis to provide the education at the university level. And that would be a saving. There might be other situations, though, where if a student wants to take a science course or whatever, it may be more expensive at the university level or the community college level to provide their education than it would be at the high school level. Because of this, it's not, we can't put a dollar figure on that. But there's a third set of issues that are independent of these first two, and that is the distribution of funds, or how this program would affect the amount of money that was available to school districts and the amount of money that was available to community colleges and to the higher education system. And we can talk a little bit more about that, though again, all of our estimates would be fairly uncertain. What I've done here is I've distributed a one-page little very brief table that looks at this issue. And if I could run through that with you briefly, Madam Chair, this will sort of explain some provisions of the bill as well. This is trying to figure out an estimate of what school district payments might be under this bill for their students that are attending post-secondary education. What we do at the top of that table is we look at how many students might actually participate in the program. The program's open to 11th and 12th graders. These are the numbers of 11th and 12th graders. There are about 74,000 students roughly in these two grades in public schools in Oregon. We have to make some assumption about the participation rate. Apparently, the participation rate in Minnesota is about 6% for their similar program. When we asked the Oregon University System to look at this program, they estimated that there might be enrollment between 8 and 11% of eligibles. Looking at the range from 6 to 11, I just said, well, let's assume that we have 8% of students participate. There would be a little under 6,000 students participating in that program under that scenario. And then the question is, well, how much of these students that are participating, what would they actually be doing? Again, based on some of the Minnesota information, most of these students don't entirely leave the public education system and go full-time at the community college, but they would take perhaps a quarter load on average at the post-secondary. So they'll take some classes there, but most of their education would still be at, in the high school. If we assume that there's a quarter, you know, that on average the participation is one quarter, then you would get about 67,000 credit hours. What this bill would, the payments that this bill provides a maximum capped payment, that's to say a maximum that the school district has to pay per credit hour. The Legislative Revenue Office estimates that that maximum, based on this year's 98, you know, the program had been in effect, since the cap is 90% of the general purpose grant per weighted student under the state school fund, that would amount to about a cap of $87 per credit hour. That's because the general purpose grant under the state school fund this year is about $4,350. The cap is 90% of that, so it's a little over $3,900. And on a credit, that would be for a full-time student, 45 credits. Per credit, it would be about $87. So if you multiply the $87 per credit by the 66,757 estimated credit hours, you get about a $5.8 million annual expense here. So these would be payments that school districts are making to community colleges or higher ed institutions or private colleges. Although that's the cap, though, the $87 is the cap, my reading of the bill is that the actual payment isn't necessarily that cap amount, but it is the actual tuition and fees that are actually being charged, which may be less than the cap amount. What I did in that next line is I said, well, let's assume that half of these students end up going to community colleges, and the other half end up going to OUS higher ed colleges. Since the average tuition at a community college is about $1,600 for a full-time student, that's less than $87 a credit hour. So if half of the students are in community colleges and half of them are in higher ed, where we have an average tuition of about $3,400 per year, the costs are less. And the estimate here would be about $3.7 million under that scenario. Of course, we don't know how many students will go to the community college. These are all estimates, obviously. But these are some of the impacts that, we've looked at so far.
Okay.
I'm sure. Do we have any of this now happening? And if so, how is it paid for now? Do some students go to universities or to community colleges, and how do we pay for it now?
My understanding is that there are some arrangements like this that do now exist in the state, but these are not statewide programs, and I really don't have that much information as to how these currently work. Hopefully, they may be
paid by the parents. That's the way it works.
Representative Ash?
Well, they are widely paid for by parents across the state. There are programs like this, and this is happening. The parents are paying. Some community colleges have specific arrangements with specific high schools whereby the high schools are already paying part of the cost directly.
Is that the 2+2 program?
Well, some of that and some others as well, and then also some community colleges have specific programs where they exempt incoming students from the first few credit hours, especially if they fall into some at-risk category. So there's a whole bunch of efforts by community colleges to accommodate them, some paid by high schools and some not. But the four-year college credit, I don't know of any program where there's anything except the parent paying.
Senator Gordon?
Madam Chair, I think the questions that are being raised right now can be answered through the testimony.
Absolutely.
OI, these are folks who
know what they're talking about.
Yes. Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and members, I'm Gary Carlson with Associated Oregon Industry. Thank you for the opportunity today to appear before you and support this important bill. We've long been involved in educational quality improvement in the state of Oregon. I think the Nation at Risk report in 1983 was sort of a wake-up call early for everyone, and it documented the shortcomings our educational system has had in this country, including reduced SAT scores from those levels a few decades ago, high dropout rates that average about 25%, math and science achievement levels ranking last among our industrialized competitive countries, high levels of remediation in advanced education institutions for incoming freshmen, adult literacy rates that now rank as last among the industrialized nations. Our own contributions toward improving educational quality in the state of Oregon go back quite a few years. We started out in the late 80s with some video productions where we brought together some of the best, most successful school administrators, first of all, in the state of Oregon, and then documented their successes, and we also followed that with bringing together some from around the country, some of the best school principals and administrators who have succeeded in bringing their young people in very disadvantaged situations to national averages. In addition, we brought internationally recognized educators from some of our competitive countries who are recognized in their own countries as being leaders in educational achievement, and had them interact with some of our own educators in the state of Oregon and documented that process with videos that were distributed to all Oregon schools and, in fact, distributed beyond our boundaries around the country as well. We also, one of our own goals was to recognize educational achievements in the state of Oregon, and so for seven consecutive years, we conducted educational excellence awards, raised money from our membership, awarded 30 teachers and principals and schools with $1,000 checks at a gala, I would call it a black tie equality events in Portland, which were very uplifting, very strongly supported by our membership, I think, in the education community. A little bit more recently, in the mid-1990s, we organized and funded what we call the Oregon Business Education Fellowship Program, which brought together a teacher, a school principal, and a business representative from each of 15 different localities, different communities around Oregon. So we put them together for a full week with facilitators from UCLA to help them to plan a management strategy for improving their school. Followed that up with reports back from those partners in each of those communities about the accomplishments they were able to make as a result of this fellowship activity. So I think we've demonstrated our interest, strong interest in trying to improve the quality of our educational offerings. A little more than a year ago now, we organized what we call the Workforce Summit in Portland. Again, that reflected the strong concerns of our members about the needs of society in terms of educational quality achievement by our young people. The governor's office co-hosted that with us, along with the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council, and we drew 500 people, including educators and business people and labor representatives from around the state. Several recommendations came out of that conference, one of which was to replicate the successful programs that we saw in other states like Minnesota, Washington State, to the north of us, Colorado, and others, which was embodied in Senate Bill 428. Senate Bill 428 is really a replication of the Minnesota program. What we did was to ask legislative council to take the statute in Minnesota and to draft it into Oregon code in a proposed piece of legislation. So it's really modeled directly after the Minnesota program. In our view, Senate Bill 428 has three primary goals: to reduce the high school dropout rate, to accelerate educational achievement, and to provide more educational options and opportunities for our young people. And the concept, as you've heard, is really quite simple. A high school student who has completed the 10th or 11th grade and applies for admission to a higher ed institution and is accepted by that institution, that's the key, is the acceptance by the higher ed institution. Then that student would be allowed to enroll in the higher ed institution either full or part-time, while also maintaining an enrollment status in the high school. And typically, Mr. Staff has mentioned, in Minnesota and these other states, the experience has been that students will take one or two courses under these programs, and typically they will not leave and go full-time to a higher ed institution. But that option is there, and some students find it to their greatest advantage, both from a social standpoint, perhaps for kids who do not fit well into the high school environment, and do fit better into a higher ed institution. If they do, they do leave and go full-time and earn dual credits and thereby take greatest advantage, I think, of this program. the students are required to be treated as high school students. They are duly enrolled under this program, so they have all the rights and privileges of students in the high school to participate in athletics, other student activities, graduation ceremonies, anything that they would be permitted to participate in as a regular student of the high school. As your staff mentioned, in Minnesota, this program has been in operation for 10 years, and their experience is about 6% to 7% of their eligible students, 11th to 12th graders, participate in what they call their post-secondary enrollment options program. And that is 6 to 7% of the numbers of students, and they may take as little as one course, all the way to leaving and attending full-time higher ed institution. We anticipate that many of these students are students who without this program would actually drop out of high school. And to the extent that this occurs, our first goal to reduce the dropout rate would be achieved. To the extent that students attend an alternative higher education institution entering concurrent credits toward high school graduation and advanced degree, our second goal of accelerated educational achievement will be realized. During testimony in the Senate Education Committee, an 18-year-old named Jerome Cole testified as a former high school dropout about how much this program would have helped him in achieving his educational goals. I did not call Mr. Cole and ask him to come today. I think he would have enjoyed his testimony, but in the interest of time, a short schedule towards the end of the session here, I simply attached his testimony to the Senate Education Committee to my testimony for your review. I think you'll find it interesting. While some opportunity for dual credit coursework are available in Oregon, as you already heard, they are not uniformly available throughout the state. And our goal with this bill is to make it uniformly available to all students, not just to some by the accident of where they were born or where their parents currently reside and work, but to make it available to all students across the state. And I think now with the advancement of the internet and the ability to take advanced education coursework over the internet, we can say that this opportunity is truly available to every young person if this bill is adopted in the state of Oregon. The report issued by the joint boards of the Oregon University System, the Oregon Department of Education, and the Office of Community College Services, issued just last November 1998, I think you heard about it already, called for expansion of these kinds of opportunities in Oregon's education system. Madam Chair and members, this bill, in our view, really should not necessarily be before your subcommittee, because the concept of this bill is that it would cost no more money to offer our young people the opportunity to earn joint credit and to accelerate their education. The concept of the bill is that the money would follow the student to their choice of educational institution. This bill, Senate Bill 428A, before you, without the proposed Dash A 11 amendments, which Senator Hartung gave us permission to get drafted for your consideration, which we support, will require the public to pay, in essence, twice, or at least more than they should have to pay for the education for each of these young people who participate. The financial reality is demonstrated, I think, by the sheets attached to the testimony that I've titled Finance Consideration, using an example, first of all, of a full-time student, the rare student who decides to go full-time to a higher education institution, and a student who takes the other extreme, one 3-credit-hour course at a community college. And you can see the numbers, I think, fall out as on a full-time student basis, the state school formula looking forward of estimated $4,600 on a community college example, where the tuitions are much lower than the university system. Full-time student would have a tuition liability, and in this case, the K-12 district would pay that liability for the student of about $1,600, estimating about $200 in books and materials. $2,800 then would stay with the K-12 district, even though the student would not be on the campus of the high school during the day. college institution, of course, receives the tuition payment and the state general fund allocation to the community colleges. And in essence, the public then is paying twice or at least more than they would if the student were enrolled independently, for example, as either a high school student or as a community college student. The Dash 811 amendments really set up an arrangement where the money does follow the student and sets up an environment where the customer is really the student and the student's family as to where the public education dollars set aside for them is in their minds best utilized. And you can see the example, I think, with the other extreme, which is the single course that might be taken by a student. Madam Chair, members, we strongly endorse this concept of 428A. We believe that any advantage you can give our high school juniors and seniors in achieving their educational goals is something that we ought to do as a state. However, we don't believe that the taxpayers ought to be asked to pay, in essence, twice for the same education. I think that's why this subject resulted in a referral by the Senate Education Committee, chaired by Senator Hartung, and Senator Gortley also serves on that committee. Why it was referred here for your review, I think primarily of the financial implications, but we wanted you to also be aware of the policy that was discussed extensively in Senate Education Committee for allowing this option for our young people. We'd be happy to answer any questions you might have, and I look forward to working with you as you consider this important legislation of this session. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary, would you develop for us the idea of the value of an accelerated education? I see two of the points here with this whole idea of reducing the dropout rate and accelerating educational achievement. So could you talk to us a bit about the value, as you perceive it, of accelerating the education?
Certainly. I think what we're talking about, we talk a lot in the state about seamless education. I think that this bill, more than just about any concept I can think of, creates a truly seamless educational opportunity for young people. Mr. Cole, if I might refer to his testimony before the Education Committee, talked about and admitted that he simply was socially immature in high school. He had a very difficult time in two high schools in Clackamas County where he came from. He was making poor grades, and yet he's a very intelligent young man. He dropped out after the end of his sophomore year. The summer following his sophomore year, he took the GED course, did the GED test and passed it, and enrolled in Portland Community College the next fall. Because of his financial situation, he was forced to work virtually full time in order to pay not only his own room and board, family was not able to support him at that point, as well as tuition, books, and fees to attend college. And it was a very difficult struggle for him, as you might imagine. But this program, I think, you can see, would have been tailor-made for this particular young man. That is one type of student, I think, who would benefit tremendously from this program. Other students who would benefit, and you'll see in the towards the back of the testimony, sort of a one-page summary out of the legislative auditor report in the last two or three years in the state of Minnesota, that 97% of the students were satisfied with this program in Minnesota, as were most of their parents, post-secondary administrators, and directors of alternative secondary schools. And the students' participation, the main reasons for their participation were, one, to get a head start in college credit, and two, to save money. And there is a substantial savings to these young people and their families. And we talked about an average of $15,000 to $20,000 in debt as a typical graduate out of the public university system in this state. You can see an advancement a young person could make on reducing that potential debt load from this proposal. And third, to take challenging or otherwise unavailable courses to them from enrollment in the high school. Well, I think that probably summarizes it in terms of what we would expect and hope out of this legislation from a state that's had at least 10 years' experience with it.
Thank you.
Representative Beckman?
Thank you, Chair. Gary, I like ideas, and I've given a lot of thought to Senate Bill 428. I also have a rich background in public school education, having been there a long, long time. And I think the implication in many people's minds is that public school education is somehow failing. And I would offer a rebuttal to that. I've taught advanced placement U.S. history since 1972. Advanced placement U.S. history allows high school kids to gain college credit while they're still in high school if they take and pass a test, a 3-hour and 15-minute essay objective test prepared by the College Board in Princeton, New Jersey. So I think the NARI has had a huge number of kids take an AP U.S. history. We also have AP European history. We have AP calculus. We have college writing, which allows high school kids to take an English class, a writing class in high school, and community colleges and four-year schools automatically accept that. I think at the upper level, we are doing very, very, very well with honors programs, college prep programs, advanced placement programs, and that kind of thing. So I don't know that our very best students, I don't know if they're being targeted or not, if they respond to this or not, because many kids love the high school setting because of the social and the athletic opportunities and the drama, and I don't know that that would be impacted either, but I do have some questions about that, and I did want to editorialize on the success of public high schools in certain areas. So anyway, I don't know if that's a question, Gary, or if I just editorialized. I don't know, but it's done, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Beckland, I'd be pleased to, and I agree with that. And taking my own kids as an example, they were both excellent students right here in Salem. They went all the way through Salem Public Schools. I don't think either of them would have chosen to leave the campus because they were engaged in the entire high school experience. They both took advanced placement courses, where they were offered. Incidentally, one of the effects in Minnesota, the measured effects in Minnesota over the 10-year period was a doubling of the number of advanced placement courses offered in the high schools of Minnesota, as the high school sought to seek out the needs and desires of those high school students. They found that they wanted and needed more advanced placement courses. And so they began to offer them. And I think you see the same thing happen here. That's why I think it's reasonable to look at this as an option. Because certainly it's not appropriate for all students, as you can see by the experience in these other states. A fairly small percentage, really, participate to the least or the greatest extent. But it is an option for those kids who need a different experience, and we would make it then available for them. I think an encouragement for them to go on with their education rather than to drop around, drop out and search for several years, perhaps, to determine what will meet their life goals best in the way of education.
Representative Edwin?
Thank you. Thank you, Gary, for bringing this proposal. I have a few questions about this. I guess, could you just elaborate a little more, and I think this picks up on what my good friend from Kaiser was talking about. Who are we talking about here? What are the students in Minnesota? Do you have statistics that show that these were potential dropouts and they needed an additional challenge? Or, I mean, I think we can all kind of generalize about who dropouts are, but and a lot of times maybe kids who are either academically not challenged or those who just have other interests and then drop out. Do you have statistics on who this, what Minnesota's experience was with that?
I'm sure, in other words, I do have a stack of material about this high in my office, and I'd be glad to try to find some distillation for you of some of that research. I've done a lot of research in Minnesota about the Minnesota experience, so I can look for that and see if I can find a distillation for you. I think the summary, my recollection of the data is that the kids who are college bound, who are in academic track, are the largest segment of those students who take advantage of this program. Surely, but I think there are some of these other components of the students who take advantage of the program who do not necessarily fit that category.
I just had Senator Shannon here, so I wanted to.
Well, if you want to bring her up, and I'll. Her idea is.
Can you hold the questions, let her pass by, and then we'll continue with them.
Sure.
Thanks for the patience.
Hi, Gary. Thank you very much. I'm Marilyn Shannon, State Senator from District 15. And. I like AOI, and I just want you to know that. And they rated me my last two sessions with my votes, and I am one of the five top senators that vote with AOI on their issues. I would have 100% if I didn't agree with them on education. That's where I get marked down. And my concern with AOI on education is, and I'm very direct about this, it used to be, in my opinion, that parents were the consumers of education on behalf of their children. But this new school reform, with its wonderful rhetoric, it's changed. And corporations have become the consumers of education on behalf of their bottom line. And at first, I had no opinion on school reform, school to work, and all of that. Now I formed a very strong opinion. And I really like the questions about Minnesota and what is happening, because I am absolutely sick to the pit of my stomach and into my inner bones about us experimenting with Oregon's children. I think that there's enough going on in education in the country today that we should not adopt one new policy till it has had a strong record of success. And this expensive experiment that is going on now is costing our children. And I know that we had in our last, we closed down education, it may reopen, but we really had only one teacher who was carrying out this legislator's idea of educating people. And she said to me, which was very sad, and this is just free, this is not directly to the bill, but she said, I am so concerned, she was from Bethel School District, which is Springfield, from grade one, and we now have permanent portfolios, we're testing these kids, and it does not meet the standard, does not meet the standard, does not meet the standard. I have a grandson who's in first grade. He's reading truly. I'm a first grade teacher at fourth or fifth grade level. And I visited with his teacher, and she barely has him at second grade level because now the standard is so high. And what happens to these kids, according to and this is my opinion, but I believe that we're trying to set the standard so high that corporations will have more workers. More widget puts together, somebody said, but more worker bees, and we'll have a few that are on the fast track, the high track, the few that can meet, and they'll be our managers, our corporate people, and all that. And I'll tell you, when AOI lost my complete confidence to have a real valuable input in education was when, in 1995, in the conference committee, when their lobbyist said, you must keep the words in there, compliance. Because corporations want, you can say corporations, but because we have to, business wants compliant workers. And that's when I checked out, lost all confidence in AOI, and I think that this is totally more schoolwork, more promotion of the school reform, and the bottom line is it's a grab for the K-12 money to put it into to higher ed. That's my opinion. I know we have an excellent committee administrator in Senate, Jan, in the Senate Ed. I was surprised that this bill said that we passed it, you know, with a recommendation to pass, because I thought we just passed it out of committee. But my advice to you is to leave the school reform alone until we have some record of success that it's working, and don't take more money away from K-12 because of this convoluted idea.
Any questions?
I just and I couldn't sit still without having an editorial comment, since I happen to have been one of the individuals from the business community that AOI extended an invitation to me to be a part of their week-long leadership session. And that dealt with trying to get the greater community involved in education for two purposes, so that the greater community would have a stake in what was going on, as well as support some of these budgets. And I have to say, I'm sitting here today because had it not been for that week that I spent with educators and principals and others to talk about what was needed in the school system, I probably would have never ran. And because I met some wonderful teachers and principals from around this state who talked about their issues and their needs and concerns for a continuum in education. And so I just want to put it in perspective, and maybe you see it as corporation takeover. I saw it as a business person coming in and wanting to be a part of the process and lending my skills and talents and my dollars, too, to fund and to make sure that in Oregon we have a quality education. I just want to go on the record.
Sure. Are you still in touch with those teachers? Do they support this?
Well, the ones, it wasn't just this subject, Marilyn. It's talking about the needs of education in our state. Quality education, and not just K-12, but a seamless education. I think sometimes we segment education to the point and we battle against each other rather than talking about what do we really think that education should be in the state of Oregon, and the ability and the willingness to pay for it.
Remember, education is our highest priority. 58% of the budget goes to education.
Yeah.
And I just think it should stay in K-12 for those kids.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Senator.
Hi.
Wanted to ask your perspective on something. Since I've been here in the last 4.5 months, I've noticed a lot of talk from industry about a worker shortage that is coming in the years ahead. And along with that, I have heard a tremendous amount of talk about aspects of reform, such as school to work and acceleration and so forth, that seem to me to be designed to get young people into the workforce as quickly as possible. Is that your observation? Is that part of what you're saying to us today?
I think it's workforce and people that will be satisfied with a lesser wage because they haven't qualified for a higher one. You see, I don't think there's anything wrong with kids going into these worker training, but knowing a little Shakespeare. I didn't learn 25 lines of Shakespeare until I was in 11th grade. And I think that it's okay. I think they want to train our kids, and I think I want to have them educated, and there is a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions for Commissioner?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. I'll try to move on quickly if we can, because I'm cutting this. Representative Deborah?
Thank you. Well, let me ask just two more questions. I guess, you know, I've been told that there are already arrangements by local districts with local universities, community colleges, so what's the problem? Are locals not doing it right, and are some doing it better than others? The uniformity, isn't this an issue of letting the district decide if it wants to get into these arrangements? And I'm not taking away from the fact that I think the concept of linking the two is good, but I'm trying to balance this should we be mandating this? I mean, you're saying it should be uniform. Is there a problem? I guess that's my question.
Chair Representative Edwards, I think our interest is in seeing it available to all kids statewide. We have no objection to the programs that are in place. I think they're good programs. But we, in this state, I've observed over the years, have a very localized approach to things. In this instance, for example, Shemeketa Community College, what arrangements they may have developed and worked out with their high schools in this area may be quite different from Rogue Community College. There may be no program at all in some of these areas, which is the case. In other cases, the arrangements differ. That's fine, but it does not provide the same opportunity to kids in the state, no matter where they live. And I think that's our interest in seeing this available statewide.
To put it in business terms, I mean, if there's a demand, there would be a supply. So I'd assume that if the local community district school wanted to enter into agreement with a demand, for example, in Portland, our TAG program is non-existent. You might look at those talented kids as a potential tool, but I guess I'm trying to figure out, I don't believe my district is holding them back. So I'm just trying to figure out where the balance is. I think the concept has some merit. I think if it helps drop out, I think that has some merit. I'm not grasping the need to mandate this. I mean, that's where I guess I'm still having a little bit of problem with the policy. I guess that's more of an editorial. And the last thing is, it seems to me maybe the one way with which you're going to, it's issues of money, I think, is what you're really getting at. And maybe one of the ways to get at that is to limit. I mean, I think at some point you got to decide, is this child a high school student or a college student? You're saying in high school, regardless of how many credits they take. And I'm saying maybe at some point, maybe if you only cap it, maybe only allow them to take two courses outside of the high school, and then you adjust the funding. I think you got a way at some point, when have they changed? And I don't know if this bill really addresses that, other than it takes money out of the school districts to pay for the student. And in tight times right now for school districts, I'm not sure how this all fits. Right? The concept, I think, is valid. I'm just not sure how you make it work today.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, I think we would see this as an important component of the CAM, if you will. It is one opportunity to pursue the CAM in a different way. And I would strongly urge against capping the program. I think that for some young people, the best route is to perhaps go full time. There's an article that I think I've distributed. Some of you have seen it. From the Educational News magazine, talking about a young woman in Washington State who left and went full-time, and it was just the right thing for her to do. And, I think what we're trying to do is create opportunities for young people to design their own best educational future. That's really what it comes down to.
President
Bush?
Just following up on what Representative Edwards said, the advantage of what we're doing is that it actually provides the opportunity for any student that needed this to go regardless of the funding of their family or their capacity to do it.
Yes.
Isn't that?
Yes.
That's the basic, and that it doesn't leave it to a local decision making to decide whether a student could take advantage of other courses than other the AP that their high school takes.
Exactly.
In your view, what is the downside for the high schools in terms of having to finance this out of a limited budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, I think the question that you raise is one basically of what are the financial dynamics of this with regard to the high school. And I think one thing that we talked about briefly a few minutes ago was responsiveness in a competitive environment what happened in Minnesota, the doubling of the advanced placement course. I think the school systems, the public K-12 school systems responded in that state to an environment which said, you don't have a captive audience, you don't have dollars coming to you based on the number of students you have. To some small degree, you are now going to face a competitive environment, and they responded. To hold those students, and in the process, I think those students were benefited. The schools retained those dollars, and we had a better end educational product. If that addresses your question in part, I mean that's what I hear you asking is the what is going to happen in the high school finance environment with this program. I think probably in Oregon, because we have these localized programs in certain areas, it's not as dramatic a change as it was perhaps in states like Minnesota.
A follow-up. I don't know if you've really looked at it this way, but some schools can't offer the range of electives that they were able to offer previously when they had more funding. And this would seem an opportunity for students to explore in depth and with seriousness areas that the high school couldn't provide elective courses in. Is that part of your consideration?
I think that would be a benefit of the program, certainly. I've not thought about it in those terms, but I think you're correct.
Thank you,
ma'am. Any other questions? Senator
Trost. I know that the AOI has been very, very strong on the school reform and the new SIM and CAM requirements and the assessment that accompanies all of that. My question is, one, would this option be available to a student who had not been able to pass the assessments and achieve the SIM? Did you let that person out of those requirements?
Madam Chair, Senator Tro, it would be available to a student who was in the 11th or 12th grade, regardless of the SIM.
Would they? You're suggesting that they remain a high school student even though they've changed their, whether they're taking a single course or whether they're going full time, would they then still be expected to do the assessments and achieve the STEM before they are as are the requirements?
Madam Chair, Senator Cho, yes, I believe that's the way it should work.
And with regard to the CAM, somebody who wants to go to university full-time would still be expected to have a CAM as well.
Yes, Senator Tro, the CAM, I think, fits hand in glove with this concept in the dual credit approach.
The other question is the double funding. You say that you don't particularly like the amendments that were prepared to provide additional funding, which our estimate would be $3 million or something like that. You believe that within the level of funding that may get to the public schools, they should be able to fund this program without that amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Tro, yes, I think the numbers demonstrate that essentially in situation of scarce public dollars, you're overpaying in the aggregate for the education of the students that choose this option if we're made available to them.
Does anyone have the authority to suggest that this is not a good option for the student? Students need counseling. Oftentimes they need to make such decisions. Should somebody at the high school have the authority to say, look, this doesn't make sense for you, and be able to say, no, don't do this? You're saying that you're sort of leaving it up to whatever institution it might be that's offering a non-religious course that they might take it. But that sends them off to a variety of institutions, both public and private, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Trowe, the bill, initial bill, required counseling of students who contemplate this option by the high school, but not a veto power by the high school over their desire to participate in this program. In amendments proposed by the Oregon University System that were added that are included in the Ingros version, the receiving higher ed institution is also required to provide counseling to students involved in this program. So they have a counseling requirement in this bill on both the high school level and at the higher ed institution.
Well, one of the problems at both of those levels is that there's not adequate counseling. I think you know that. And there's not money in the public school budgets to pay for adequate counseling, and many schools have very poor counseling, generally. Higher ed counseling is always a problem. I've been there. I know. It's just really hard to get students counseling.
Madam Chair, Senator, just another brief comment. I think there will be some false starts for individual students, some mistakes that they will realize if they made a mistake. This has been documented in the other states that have these programs. But these are not irreversible decisions. These are situations where these young people perhaps were getting themselves into an environment they were not fully aware of, and they can retrench and fall back.
Any other questions? Senator Gordon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, just a couple of comments. Mr. Carlson, first of all, thank you very much for bringing the proposal forward, thanks to AOI. I supported this bill in the Senate Education Committee, and I'm prepared to support it again here because I support the goals that Mr. Carlson has defined for the Student Bill of Rights. And again, going back to your prepared testimony, looking at reducing the high school dropout rate, and that's a serious issue in our state. We're looking at accelerating the educational achievement, and I would just tag on to that for all students. One of the things that has impressed me about AOI, and I found this kind of surprising, it was my discovery, is that the organization does have a focus on disadvantaged youth, what's happening with those youth who are being left behind in our educational system as we know it. And the workforce summit, which I attended, was an opportunity to sharpen our focus on what it is we need to do to make sure that we increase the educational opportunities for that because we don't want to leave anyone behind. So I look at this proposal as it is a tool. We can build on, we can look closely at the Minnesota experience and the experience of the other states. It is a tool, and it is a tool that can hopefully help us reach all of the kids. I'm particularly concerned about kids of color. Folks on this committee have heard me say this before. Folks on the Senate Education Committee have heard me say that as well. We need as many tools and programs and ideas as we can get our arms around to make sure that we're not leaving any of our kids behind. Another attractive feature of this proposal is that school districts are directed to inform students and parents about the option. The students and the parents are making the decision about what's in the best educational interest of that child, and I think that is also I think that's as it should be. The last comment I'll make, Mr. Carlson, goes to the comments at the back of your testimony. Actually, it's not comments, but the nation at risk, a nation still at risk update, which comes from 1998. And the paragraph that just jumps out at me is the third one that says that we learned just last month that American 12th graders scored near the bottom on the recent third international math and science study, whatever the CIMSF is. U.S. students placed 19th out of 21 nations in math, 16th out of 21 in science. Our advanced students did even worse, scoring dead last in physics. This evidence suggests that compared to the rest of the industrialized world, our students lag seriously in critical subjects vital to our future. That's a national shame. And I think, you know, we may be doing very well in a lot of areas. You know, we all like to talk with pride about how well we do in Oregon in any given area. But the fact is, we're not doing as well as we can. We need to do better, and for all of our students. And so again, if my remarks are disjointed this morning, I apologize for that, but I'm just saying that I support the proposal. And thank you for bringing it forward. Keep your focus on disadvantaged young people, and let's move this forward.
Thank you, Senator Gurley. I was sitting here thinking how to respond to that. You know, that paragraph you just read is, you know, I don't believe that we're not, as a country, inherently dumber than our competition. You know, we can do this, but we've got to scrape and think and come up with new ideas and improve the way we're doing things because we're not competing educationally right now, internationally.
Thank you.
Okay, I just had some mechanical questions, okay. And maybe staff or Mr. Carlson can answer these, because I'm not grasping exactly how the financial end of this works out. The institution of higher ed can refuse to admit the students, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and they can do that just based on their judgment. We don't like the way you come here.
No. That's what about sick?
Yeah, I'm in trouble with you.
I think that the bill would not require there to be different admission requirements for these students than for other students. So in terms of prerequisites that might be needed for a particular course or for admission to the program in general, the institutions would be able to maintain their standards.
Okay, so if for objective reasons they felt the student wasn't ready to take a specific course, they could say, no, you're not ready.
Correct.
Okay. But does the high school have any parallel authority to say to a student, you haven't finished your requirements here at Corvallis High School, and so you can't start taking all these credits? In other words, if the student hadn't really finished their requirements for high school graduation and weren't going to finish them if they started taking all these college courses, would that still be an option open to them? So the high school has no, am I right in assuming that?
The students would be able to take the college courses in lieu of high school courses. They would still have to meet the same requirements to get a, you know, to graduate from high school, but the courses that they took at the post-secondary level would be eligible to meet those requirements. They would, under this legislation, my understanding is that they would, they being the school district, would provide information to students as to which courses would be eligible to meet the high school requirements, the high school graduation.
Okay, so the question I'm really asking, though, is as a high school senior, could someone say, I am not interested in graduating from high school, but I am specifically interested in getting free credits to college, and so I'm going to take advantage of this program and not pay for college because my high school has to pay for it, and I don't care if I graduate or not, but I'm going to start on a full-scale college curriculum here free, and that the high school wouldn't have any authority to say, no, wait a minute, Sharon Minnis, you're not even graduating from high school if you do this, and we're happy to have you take some classes, but we don't think you should take your entire freshman year at our expense and not be headed to our graduation.
Chair, do you have an answer to that?
Madam Chair, Rosa Ross, to me it's an issue that probably won't have much significance. I think that the young people who are interested in this opportunity are young people who are interested in not bypassing but accelerating their educational achievement. There is an appeal process to credit granting by the high school toward achievement of the high school diploma on page 3 of the Ann-Groves bill to the state board of education, which is whose decision is final about whether or not that advanced course qualified for credits toward the high school graduation requirement.
And so that was really the question I was asking. The high school is required to pay for it, and so do they have some control over if a student is taking classes that would not qualify for high school credit, can they say, we're not going to pay for this because it's not something that would qualify for high school credit in any way?
I can say that it does not qualify for credit towards high school graduation.
And they could say, no, what, I'm going to pay for it?
I don't believe that's addressed in the bill.
Okay. Okay, so I'm concerned about this. I like the concept of the program, but I'm concerned about the financial impact on high school with no check by the high school in terms of what is valuable for a student or how their classes fit in with the other requirements. That's really my only concern. I agree with Senator Gordley's positive responses to the bill. And especially, it really also relates to the level of financing we're able to give K-12, because if we get to the 495 level and people have a little more flexibility, then this is easier for them to accommodate and work with than if they are still struggling with their overall financial picture. Thank you, Minister.
Thank you.
I have a question, maybe someone can answer. If that same young man dropped out of school, then the funding is discontinued anyway, isn't it? Do you continue to maintain the funding?
Well, I think Representative the members just brings up an interesting question of, and I think it relates to some of the comments that Mr. Carlson was making. The funding that's provided to a particular district and the funding that's provided overall are really determined by two different factors. When I mean overall, I mean to all the districts and to all community colleges and to all higher ed. Those funding levels are not based, total funding is not based on the total number of students who enroll. Not in community colleges, not in higher ed, and really not in K-12 either. How the state funding are distributed amongst institutions does depend on the enrollment. So we have to look at those two situations separately. If someone drops out of high school, it is correct that they are not counted in that school district's ADMW, so they do not receive the distribution. But the total amount of funding that the state's providing is not reduced. We don't reduce the appropriation if more kids drop out than was expected or anything like that.
Follow-up. Is the federal, any funds coming from the federal reduced because of dropout or non-attendance?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that. I will try to better the conditions.
This is a question for Gary. When does the student have to decide that they're going to do this? Before, which goes to this enrollment, about when they get caught up in either school enrollment or...
No, Chair Representative Edwards, it's March of the year prior to the start of the next school year. They have to declare that they intend to participate in this program.
And how many credits they want to take, anticipate to take? because the way the formula works is based on the number of credits, which affects how much a school district is going to be able to budget. Not that, again, 9% of the schools, the students is going to make a huge, well, we'll make some dent, but that's at the top level. But I guess I'm trying to figure out how much notice does a school district have? And you're saying March before the prior school year.
Yeah, basically 6 months.
And if I'm not incorrect, I think is it in September that school districts make a snapshot of their enrollment once they get the kids in the door, I think? I don't know. That's more of a question to Steve.
Yeah, there is a...
And there's another adjustment later in the year.
Again, I haven't been working on this in 12 education for a while, so we'll let you on this. But I do believe that at the beginning of the year, there is some kind of...
And at some point, I'd like to hear, I don't, unless you've done it, gone through the mechanics of how this distribution under the A11 works, depending on if you're if you're community college in or a private or public higher ed institution. So I don't know, at some point, do we get to walk through how this works?
Yeah, we will, after the public testimony, we'll evaluate and then see about bringing it back. All right.
This is for Representative Ross. I think the question that you raised earlier may be answered in Section 8 on page 3 under 345. And I won't get into the specifics.
Okay.
Just want to draw your attention to that.
I'll read it. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ozzie Rose.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I'm testifying in opposition to the bill before you. And we object in principle to the issue of using K-12 monies at higher ed. The issue of seamless education, options, et cetera, is a different issue. Unfortunately, in our environment, we can't talk about them separately. We opposed 428 when it was introduced. We took part in a work group that produced the engrossed version, in part because the votes were there to move the bill. And we produced a bill that we believe was a lot better, and we supported this amended version, and then it got sidetracked and sent down here. So I want to be sure we all understand where we were. The issues aren't, in our view, about not getting kids options. Kids need options, and we need more options for all kids. This isn't about a program for all kids in Oregon. All kids in Oregon won't have access to it unless there are higher ed institutions near enough for them to take part in it. The issue of what we have now, the programs that exist in the schools and the colleges now are built around where there are colleges and institutions available to offer the particular program. The major difference between this bill and what exists now is to do any of the advanced placement or go to the campus and so forth now takes an agreement worked out between the student, the institution, and the school district. Under this bill, any student who was admitted to a higher ed institution or a community college could move without the district having any particular say in it. And again, if money wasn't an issue, you would discuss this in a lot different way. We passed an effort to took a stand on improving our schools the early part of this decade and said we're going to have a program in which we're going to have very high standards and all of our kids are going to reach those standards, not just part of them, not just the college bound, but all of our kids. Then we came right back the next, and part of that program, we're going to extend the school year to 210 days because one of the things we know about learning is we don't learn at the same pace, and if you have time, more kids will learn more. But the first thing we did in the next session was, oops, that's pretty expensive. So we did away with that part of it, but we didn't leave. We didn't change the rest of it. We took out the core part of how you might get all third graders to reading by the end of third grade by taking away the time we would have spent on it had we kept the original. We also, since we introduced the idea of an improved program, have increased the funding on a weighted per student basis at about 60% of the rate of inflation over this decade. And I'm not arguing that we ought to have the same rate of growth as inflation. But clearly the rate of inflation has something to do with what it costs to do things. And our dollars per weighted student have increased to about 60% of the CPI, Portland CPI, in this decade. So the resource issue behind moving all of our kids has not been addressed very well in our view. Specifically to the issue of accelerating, et cetera, I have a youngster, and all of you know these stories because I tell stories about my youngster a lot. I have a right to do that. I'm old and I have youngsters. And everybody's using anecdotes. My freshman, because he's going to a high school that has gone to the alternate days and they have a longer period, so they have four periods one day, they essentially have an eight-period program. My youngster, by the end of his junior year, will be within one course of being able to graduate. I could lean on him just a little bit and get that course in summer school between his sophomore and junior year or his junior and senior year at Chemeketa, and he will have completed everything he needs to get a diploma. And then I can say, come on, Michael, get your little self over to the community college for free and do your whole freshman year. And for my first year on Social Security, I won't have to pay for college. Salem School District will pay for it. And anecdotes aren't fair, but they're used against us a lot. And I think we have to think about this. Every kid needs options. And the young people that Senator Gordy talked about, we need more options for those young people. And we don't do it by shifting our resources off to the higher ed. And this is a resource-driven fight, not a fight about whether kids need us. And I think we ought not do this at this time. And with that, I will answer any questions.
Thank you. I have a question just to follow up on the comment that you made about every kid needs options and specifically thinking about the district in Portland, which probably has the highest dropout rate. And so how would you, you said we need more resources. But in the interim, if we talk resources, we have a large population of kids who are not being able to access these options. So do you have some words of wisdom or counsel for us as to how we can solve the problem in the inner city?
Madam Chair, I think Gordy, if we were able to provide the Portland School District with the resources to create more options for those young people that are in the grade 1 through grade 12 age span and prevent the dropouts by keeping stuff that makes the school relevant, informative, desirable, et cetera, you keep them in that and you don't let them drop out. And you've read in the papers the constraints that Portland's under, and they don't do everything they know they should do and could do if they had the resources to do that. And creating an option where some of the resource they have would go off to Portland Community College or somewhere else doesn't help that problem. It may help a few kids who choose to take that option, but I'm not sure that the dropout ones are the ones that are going to take the options proposed by this bill. In AOI's testimony, they point out that my organization, Counterpart Minnesota, opposed this bill at Minnesota, and my counterpart's report now is it's not as bad a deal as they thought it was. About 6 to 10% of kids are using it. They're using it part-time, and they're by and large college-bound kids. It's not hitting the kinds of kids that we're talking about when we talk about the DRACA.
Any other questions for the show?
Could you just describe what already a program that's up and running somewhere in one district?
Great testimony. We brought in school districts before the two subsidy committees that heard this issue, and we had Beaverton, Salem, Eugene, and Albany. They all described something slightly different. I think that Representative Ross has remarked earlier that by and large, there are programs in which if you actually get college credit, the parents pay for the college credit. There are some where the districts actually pay for it. They're taught, like President Backman talked about, he teaches advanced placement and you can get college credit for it, or you can't. You can take your choice. Others are actually taught on the campuses and kids go to the campuses. It's a variety of things. And that was the point I was trying to make earlier. A number of things are happening, but they're happening where we have institutions where they can make the arrangements to make it happen. And this bill won't, I just objected to the statement, now we have a statewide plan. But statewide, it still won't affect very much kids who aren't close enough to these institutions where they can work out these arrangements. You're not going to pack up from Burns and go to take a one-hour course at a community college in Ontario.
Yeah. Although the testimony was that the Internet may provide another way of getting at it.
But the Internet will provide it under current circumstances as well. The Internet may do a lot of things for us in education. If we can afford to put in the wires so we can use it.
Other questions?
So you also oppose the Dash 11. Is that right?
The 11s have to do with, primarily, I think, with deleting some of the funding for community college, and I don't see it as an issue that needs to be addressed.
Okay.
I don't think it changes the kind of the bill that I'm concerned about.
Other questions? Thank you. Thank you. Laura Winma.
Good morning. For the record, Lori Wimmer, Oregon Education Association, and we are also in opposition to this bill and also participated on the work group. And I would like to thank AOI for the record for caring about education in general, for talking about early entry options, and we do welcome the support and collaboration of the business community in general terms, working with public schools. I'd like to say that in an ideal world, not only would we provide more early entry options for all students, but we would lower class size. We would lower special ed caseloads. We'd get rid of pay-to-play so students find schools relevant. We would restore all the lost programs we've lost in this decade of disinvestment. We'd add more skill centers. We'd have more honors and AP classes for the college-bound, more counselors, more librarians, and on. You know the list. But that is not the world we live in. The world we live in, early entry options are like so many other wonderful and worthy programs, those things that some districts are more able to participate in and others are less because of the funding realities. And because of that, we must oppose this bill. Now, one of the things that you've heard before is that there are districts already doing options of this ilk. Right here in Salem-Keizer, I know there was an arrangement with Willamette University for some students. Lane Community College and University of Oregon, I think, also have arrangements with some of the Eugene area schools. There were numbers of different programs that were listed in the two committee hearings, that, or two different sides of the building that I saw the bill, both the House side and the Senate side. With respect to the dropout rate, that question has come up. I'm familiar with a report the Department of Education puts out that lists various, the census of who is dropping out in Oregon schools, and by gender, by ethnicity, and by reasons for dropout. And there are various different reasons. And if we could solve all the problems with family dysfunction and poverty and pregnancy and alcohol and drug involvement in children and special education and tutoring needs to the maximum capacity public schools could, well, then I think that we would also be able to lower dropout rates in Oregon. And I think that we all need to redouble our efforts at working on these problems. This may be a part of that solution eventually if we're able to come up with a stable and adequate long-term funding solution for Oregon's K-12 public schools. I believe we're not there yet. And until and unless that happens, this program is, as so many are, something that's going to need to be set aside until we're able to do it. We also, of course, oppose state mandates. We believe in local control. I know many of you do, too. And we believe that forcing every school district to enter into arrangements, whether or not they're able financially to swing it, and that's, I think, probably why we have different experiences by district, is something that is an unrealistic thing to impose on schools, and it's yet another mandate by the legislature on the district if it goes all the way. And so for those reasons, we would oppose the bill. I would also point out that under this bill, an 11th or 12th grader would be getting a free college education to which, and to private or public schools, to which a 13th, 14th, or 15th grader is not entitled on the taxpayer's dime. And I think that you ought to think about, perhaps, the ramifications of that as social policy. I would love to have gone to college for free in the 11th grade. I was probably one of those kids who would have been ready to do that. It's certainly an interesting and intriguing idea, but you know, there's sometimes a tension between
meeting the needs of any one given individual student against the needs of all of those the state has the obligation to educate. So with that, I will end my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Jean Thorne.
Thank you. I'm Chair Jean Thorne of the Governor's Office. I think you'll be hearing shortly from the Department of Education about concerns about this bill. I think that the Governor has supported the concept of seamlessness, of trying to move from K-12 through community colleges and higher education. And so I think the general approach of saying let's encourage early options and for students to make their way into post-secondary is something that we do support. On the other hand, we have concerns about this bill. We currently have a variety of, and I didn't hear all of the testimony earlier, but we do have a variety of what are called early options in this state. And I think the study that was done between the Department of Education, community colleges, and higher ed last fall showed that 6 to 7% of students currently are in some type of early option where either a course is occurring at the high school or they're being given credit right and going to a 2+2 program or other type of program. I think the primary concern that we have from the Governor's office really revolves around some of the questions that you were asking Representative Ross, and I guess for lack of a better term, it's the rights part of this. In the Senate Education Committee, there was a fair amount of testimony about the kinds of options that are going on now, and where school districts are, for instance, for students who have maxed, I think as one superintendent put it, they've maxed out the courses that are available at the school, then they are working with community colleges or higher ed to have them be able to avail themselves of post-secondary courses. I think the concern here is that the district really has no ability to say, no, we have another course here at our high school that you can take advantage of, and that is the district is required to pay for the tuition at the post-secondary institution. I think some of the concerns that perhaps you'll hear from the Department of Education and that we heard from some school districts and Senate Education Committee were that as they try to have the critical mass together for the class at the high school, that as they start losing students to post-secondary and they're required to pay for that may decrease their ability to have that critical mass at the high school. And frankly, I think others also testified of concerns that it may not be appropriate for every 16-year-old or 17-year-old to go to a post-secondary campus, and it may be more appropriate for them to have those courses in the high school setting. So I just wanted to express a concern from the Governor's office about this bill and about, I think, specifically issues around the school district's ability to say we have something available locally within our high school, and concerns that may then raise around their having to pay for the courses and what that will do for their own capacity at the high school.
Okay. Questions? I just wanted to clarify one issue. If a high school had an AP physics class and they had, 25 students in it, and then 12 of them chose to go to the university physics, entry-level physics, then you'd have only half of those students back there. You'd be paying for half through a mandated program, and then you'd have only half the resources to pay your teachers.
Yes, that's my understanding of how this would work. That if my son were a junior, and rather than taking AP chemistry, he said, no, I'd rather go to Oregon State and take a college-level course, the district would be required to pay for those for that cost, but they'd still be trying to sustain the class at the school.
Other questions?
It's my understanding of this, too. Does higher ed count that student as a part of their student body?
Depending
on the number.
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, I believe they would. I
I'm saying I believe they would. I think you probably have to ask higher ed on that and how that works now with the interchange with their new budget model, how that interfaces with their new budget model.
Let's turn it back then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I read the bill that indicated the high school would continue to count that team.
I believe they both do.
They both do.
But I think someone else who's more intimately involved needs to answer them.
Okay, Greg Lampardo. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. For your record, my name is Greg McMurdo, and I represent the Department of Education, and I'm here specifically for the Superintendent of Public Instruction to express his opposition to Senate Bill 428. And our opposition stems really from the same concerns that you've heard from Dr. Rose and from Jean Thorne and from others. And that is, at a time when we're asking our schools to implement the Certificate of Initial Mastery and to plan for and implement the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, we believe this bill would divert resources from an already strained school system, and that the diversion would really be very detrimental to education reform. I think your question is quite correct. In the letter that the superintendent wrote to the Senate Education Committee, he gave the example not of a science class, but of a calculus class, where a number of the students decide whether they would rather take it at an institution of higher education. Yet the school district would still have the obligation to make that same course, and the same cost would still be there for making that course available at the local level. We also, I think the bill raises questions of equity and access for rural students. The internet can certainly help that, but I don't know that that's a complete solution. We believe that the best and brightest students would be those that would take advantage of the bill, and that it would leave, unfortunately, some of the lower performing students to continue their full-time study at the high school level. So our concerns, I think, are primarily of concerns of money at this point. We do believe that there are existing options that are available for students with respect to taking advanced credit courses in community colleges and state schools of higher education. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate your let's move on to the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Greg, getting back to the premise of the whole bill, which is to reduce the dropout rate, which I think we're all concerned with, and to accelerate educational achievement, which is something we're concerned with, too, and the board students concern us, and those students whose needs are really not being met by the current system. You know, we're all concerned about those things. Obviously, it is easiest to take care of the situation by doing nothing rather than to improve the system that we have in place to meet these things. For one reason or another, it isn't happening or not happening to the degree that is satisfactory to a number of people. In your opinion, what could we do then to the K-12 system? What could we do for it? I know the easy answer, the quick answer is probably money, but What could we do the easiest thing, which is to simply take care of the problem with the system that we currently have in place?
Chair and Representative Wilson, I believe that the implementation of the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, and it is a question of money also to implement that program, will make a vast difference. I think that from day one has been seen as one of the major steps that the state, that education reform would take as far as ending student dissatisfaction. Several years ago, when we started looking at the dropout report, we were getting raw numbers on the numbers of students dropping out, but we really didn't know why. So we asked districts to, in effect, do an exit survey of students and ask them why, if they dropped out, they were dropping out, and why, if they stayed in school, they were staying in school. And, of course, the responses we got were, I think, very obvious. And that was that they didn't feel it was relevant or it wasn't interesting to them. And the whole concept of standards-based education is to bring relevance to courses and to coursework for students. So I think that the Education Reform Act, that's what one of our purposes is, to bring relevance to the classroom.
Interesting.
Well, just maybe to comment on that, though, I think that I interpret that response relevant or interesting may or may not mean academically challenging. It just may be, I'm just tired of school. I'm going to do something completely different. I mean, I don't know if this bill would address that. And as was described earlier, that's why I wanted to see more about, in Minnesota, what was the experience about the dropouts, who were, well, what was the makeup of that? Your testimony, quite frankly, the Minnesota program was really more towards the college bound, which is a little different than just the dropout boredom, which may not be academic boredom. I think it's more, yeah, my guess is these people have a lot of reasons why they're dropping out. It has to be boredom of just not caring about school and the importance of education. I mean, I think that's more of the problem, but that's my own editorial. I don't know. Do you have anything to substantiate my...
Sure, Representative Edwards. We could not substantiate that from the survey results we got. However, the responses would lead at least me to believe that it was not just boredom with life in general at age 17 or age 16 or 18, but it was boredom with classes that were either not relevant in the student's mind or were not challenging the student. I think that's where we need to emphasize our resources.
For the A 11 amendment, make the bill any better?
I don't believe so, Senator Crowe, from for that.
Thank you very much. Grattan?
Madam Chair, given the deep concern expressed by the governor's office, the Department of Higher Education is not in a position to come forward and issue a supportive measure.
So if I'm understanding you, you're withdrawing your support for the bill?
May I say that I think that there would be an issue that at some time, if we're going to consider this bill, we ought to explore with higher ed, and that is how the student count works for higher ed and whether or not in higher ed's rather substantial recruitment of students, there would be active recruitment of these students as well. Because I would think that could pose a real problem if that were the case.
Vicki? Oh, excuse me. Senator Gordy?
I'll hold my comment.
Okay. Vicki? We'd like to get you and one other person in if we can.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Cotton, Oregon Community College Association. I have very little to add that is new. We've checked the in-between box on purpose. Conceptually, the president thinks it's a really good idea to provide more opportunities because it's in the colleges for high school students. We have a very keen concern and have from day one about the funding and not just how it would flow to us, but where it would come from. And that if it's such a very good program, we ought to find another way to fund it. That's one concern. The second concern is we don't have enough good data to tell you exactly what is going on in every school district with every college and the participation rate. Everyone who testified is correct. It's different in every district. In Greater Albany, kids can get college credit at no cost, and my daughter did the writing, college writing at Sprague, and I had to pay $35 a credit hour for her to get it. And it was taught by a Sprague teacher on her high school campus, and she graduated with 9 hours of writing credit. Mm-hmm. And it is very different. I would just add one piece to what Ozzie said about the at-risk students. I taught in high school for 5 years, and those students are not college-bound, nor are they college-ready, most of them. Very few of our top students are at risk. Some of them are. My daughter was at risk, how we define it. The bill is very clear on the very first page. A student cannot get into a college-level class unless they are college-ready. And our kids who are dropping out, who need opportunities, frankly, if you want to make it for them, you'd amend the bill and say they could take developmental courses, they could take remedial courses, because that would be the step into their next step college program. And so I would expand it in that regard if that were the case. We would object strenuously to the Dash 11 amendment. We would prefer that you allow us to have the school district, if you went forward with this, pay for the per credit participation, which is averaging about $38 an hour, And then if we counted, and right now we get about $58 per credit hour per student you allow us to count for full-time students. So we looked at the full, if you look at, you can do the math on the sheet that Steve did for you. If you start with the $39.15, that's what a community college got. $1,700 goes for tuition. We get $2,600 from the state right now for a full-time enrolled 45 hours credit per year student, and that comes to $4,300. That would be $400 short of what we're getting right now, not including any other resources. So I know you're in a hurry. I wanted to get that on the record, and thank you.
Sure.
Senator Trump?
Just a comment about the way we funded the community college budget. We didn't fund for all of our faculty students. I mean,
that was a concern I meant to note. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, public employee union that classifies school employees in K-12 districts all over the state, ESDs, community colleges, and park and rec districts. And I'm here also in opposition to Senate Bill 428. And unlike some of my colleagues, OSEA has been opposed to this bill from the beginning and remains so for a couple of fundamental reasons. The first reason is the money, where the money comes from for the education of students in higher ed under this bill. Whether they are 17 or 21, students in our higher education system are not funded, should not be funded, out of the K-12 budget, because the K-12 budget is not adequately funded now to handle the responsibilities of K-12 education, to pull more money out of K-12 when, I know it's been a long time since we talked about the K-12 budget in this committee, but I think you probably remember a lot of the stories that came from K-12 districts about the problems that they're experiencing. My members keep the buildings together as best they can, assist teachers in educating and teaching to read students who are at risk, students who are disabled. And over this decade, as Dr. Rose indicated, we have lost about 30% of our spending money. To do this, that means more classified employees are teaching children when certified teachers used to teach children at in buildings that have leaky roofs and inadequate heating and ventilation systems. We might not be here in opposition to this bill if the needs of K-12 were adequately addressed in Oregon. They are so far from being adequately addressed, we can't even conceive of draining more money out of the system for a few students who probably are going to go to college anyway. We also believe that all K-12 students should have access to the same quality education. And more disparity exists in our system as more and more districts find themselves unable to provide the kinds of programs to keep students in school. So I wouldn't suggest to you that this is not a well-meaning bill, but I would suggest to you that when a patient is bleeding, you don't cut them open a little further in an effort to save some of the blood. You patch the hole. And so I would hope that you would put this bill away until we solve K-12's problem for all K-12 students.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Well, with that, we are adjourned. Representative Edwards.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I can hold it until we're going to meet
again.
Yeah, we'll come back. He'll be back.